Welcome to Aspire. I'm your host, Gregory Penn, and I am deeply grateful to be with you on this very, very interesting June 27th day. I have a wonderful series of questions that has been offered, two of them by one person, one of our sponsors, who has been, well, with me for a long time. And I'm very, very grateful that she decided to offer her insight, her questions. It's interesting to me, constantly interesting, how people hear me and if they can hear me. And you have to put aside your prejudice if you're going to listen to Aspire. You have to put aside your bias. You have to stop thinking you already know. You know, the old saying in Zen, only don't know, becomes the prequel for everything that is presented to you in Aspire. So I get these beautiful emails from people, and sometimes they want to know about things that are pertinent to their own life, sometimes in general, you know, basically in the lives of all of us, and sometimes, very rare, but sometimes the deeply esoteric part of ourselves. So we're going to cover a lot of ground here today. And Stephanie, I want to thank you for your beautiful questions. The first two belong to her. We'll go to the first one. She asks, and by the way, Stephanie lives in San Diego. Okay, just so you know. Why do we harden our hearts so quickly, so firmly? This is a tremendous question. Most people don't want to know why they do that, and they don't even know they're doing it, Steph. The whole idea of the majority of people in this world is to be self-righteous. That's why. People love self-righteousness. It's a big part of building their identity as a person, their self-esteem, as it were. Most people can only esteem themselves through the pettiness of self-righteousness. So this is one of the survival techniques that we all use in our life in order to sustain the idea of a self. You have a self, a Stephanie. I have one as a Gregory. And so the question of a lifetime is, how far does Gregory and Stephanie go in the course of their lifetime to sustain and keep Gregory and Stephanie? How far will I go? What will I do? Will I ignore the truth for the sake of trying to be a Gregory? Will I ignore what's, you know, obviously the facts of life, as it were, and try to rearrange them or try to muffle those voices or those facts so I don't have to feel the discouragement, the embarrassment of being wrong? We've all been wrong. I've been wrong. Everybody's been wrong one way or another. So you have to look at the idea of the hardness of heart that Jesus talked about. And he would say things like, the people's hearts are wax gross. He would say things like, I would tell you things, but your heart could not bear them. I have had to go through some of that too in my own work, and even with my own self, of bearing the truth that broke my human heart. And this is why it is so important to understand why we make little or no progress in this world, is because we're all so right, every one of us. We like to think we're right about so many aspects of our daily living. We're right about our political viewpoints. That's a huge one. Our religious viewpoints. That's another big one. And then it goes down the line. How we raised our children, how we raise our children, how we think about others, or what our quote-unquote moral obligation is, or whatever looks legitimate to us. We have our ideas of being right because we want to not only fit into this very sick society, but we want to stand out in it as well. And when I'm more interested in standing out of this society, and yet keeping the righteousness of it, the very sickness of it all, that is when I have a great deal of difficulty, and that's when I will defend, my hardness of heart. So the only thing that can be done, because obviously people are not going to, in this sick society, mature. This is not an atmosphere for maturity at all. What we are going to have to do is do it on an individual basis to understand that people know not what they do. Years ago, I wrote a book called We Know Not What We Do. And every publisher looked at it and turned it down for the simple fact that it was, as they said, too candid, too graphic, and too honest. That was the words that were being used. I didn't think that it would sell. They, as they put it, we're not in the business of selling morality. We're in the business of selling books. And I found this to be very true with people in general. Sad to say that book will probably never be published, but that's not the point, really. The point is why it couldn't be published, because who's going to buy a book that is going to be telling you how wrong everything it is that you do? And I'm going to talk about this in another question, Stephanie, that I'm going to add to this broadcast at the end. But it is a very big problem. How far can a person go to realize, wow, I'm not who I thought I was. I'm not who I want to be. And I don't know who I am in the first place. And this who I am is a very interesting aspect of our life. Who is this I am? Who dictates who I am? I am what? How do you know who you are? How do you know you're Stephanie? How do I know I'm Greg? Who are these people anyway? And where do they come from? What are they derived from? What is their origins, their nature? What are they all about? This is something you have to start to look at. Do I want the real answer? And I'll give you one right now while we're on the air. The only way most of us know we're alive, Stephanie, is the mechanism. The mechanism is the biology in you. You need to read Behave by Robert Sapolsky. It's a difficult book to get through. Believe me, it is. But there are little snippets even on the internet, on YouTube. You can listen to him. And he talks about all of the chemicals in the brain, the happy chemicals that turn into unhappy chemicals, and moods and mood swings that we have. We are at the mercilessness of a human body that is filled with all sorts of chemicals that have a total effect on how we're going to live our life. And so the question becomes, this system that I have that puts me in perpetual, let's say, depression or perpetual desire or ruthless ambition or seeking happiness at the cost of everyone else in my life. I just want to pursue happiness. And I don't care what happens to anyone else as I enter into this pursuit, as it were. What does this all mean? What are we talking about here? The system is our life. The system is who we think we are. For all of our life, unless you have awakened, which you can, you're just keeping the body going. You are living according to the mechanism of the body. You and I are sustaining the body. So when somebody says, well, who is Stephanie? They think of a picture of you in their minds if they've met you, and they understand that Stephanie. Or this is Greg. But is that Stephanie? Is she the totality of the system of her body, her biology, her DNA, her genetics? Well, yeah. And is that all running without anyone in charge? Well, yeah. Who's in charge there? Is Stephanie in charge of her DNA? Is Greg in charge of his genetics? These are impulses people have, and people mainly go with impulse, and they sustain their entire life through impulse. So this keeps going on and on and on until we as a little child learn that when mommy and daddy call us a name, like Stephanie and Greg, we respond to that not because of, well, intelligence, but because of survival, because that's what we're told to be. We are named Stephanie and Greg, and then Stephanie and Greg have all sorts of attributes and personas and all sorts of dark stuff and light stuff, and there you are. You answer to that name. Why do we harden our hearts? We do it so we don't have to face that there's no one at home. We have to be right for everything. Everything has to be about righteousness, self-righteousness. It's a part of the mechanism, and it's to prove that we are, quote unquote, whatever kind of person we want to believe we are. And most people just want to believe they're good people. Oh my. And we will go to our death with this. And for the majority of human beings on the planet, go to our death not only with it, but from it, and never mature. And take that into the next life and the next life until we're done. Okay, the next question from Stephanie. Why do we desire things and stuff that will only be discarded after our death? Well, in keeping with this whole thing that I'm talking about, the stuff is the proof of our living. You need a certain amount of stuff, you know, to survive here on the planet. You need a house, you need a refrigerator, you need food, you need a toilet, you need a shower, you need clothes, you need transportation of some sort. And then from there, the luxury thing, the opulence thing happens. We want more and more and more because we see other people having more and more and more. And we think, well, they're no better than I am, and I'm better than that, and blah, blah, blah. And this is the way our psychology goes, till we think that our objects, our wealth, are the proof of our importance. Because we have no interest in authentic love, we make objects and things more important than they should be. So, all the things we desire and want are a sign that we are looking for some kind of self-esteem issue, self-importance issue. We're looking to be special, and everybody wants to be special. I have a saying, and I've had it for years, and I used to say it when I was teaching formally, pretty girls die hard. And the diehard thing is that they start to lose their looks as they get older. And then they're not turning men's heads anymore. And they'll do just about anything and everything from surgery to whatever, cosmetics, to stay attractive. But there comes a point where you lose your grip on the old rope of life. And no matter what you do, you still look old. I'm old. I look old. People will watch Aspire TV programs from 20, 30 years ago, and they, wow, you've really gotten old. Well, what do you think? Everybody gets old, but the thing is, we don't want to, so we try to become important. And we think if we have a car that is expensive or a home that is prestigious, or we have the clothes that show that we have the money to spend on that kind of luxury, that we are as individuals very successful people and that we will be regarded as special people. Stephanie, people want to be special. Who wants to be ordinary? And in Zen, in meditation, in spiritual work, authentic spiritual work, it's about engaging in the ordinary, the simple. It is not about being extraordinary. It is extraordinary to be simple. The awakened person is not a special person at all. Not at all. You would meet a Buddha, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know a thing. Many people had met him, walked right by him. Same thing with Jesus. Look at Pontius Pilate. Hey, you think he recognized anything? No. He just looked like a man, and he wanted to, you know, prove he was the king of the Jews and he could die the way normal men do, and they do. If you inhabit a fleshly body, you're going to live in the modality of that body in a world that accepts that modality and supports it, like this world. You've got to eat, you've got to drink water or have some kind of liquid. And then there are all sorts of laws and principles to living in this world. And it's not about being successful. One of the things that used to bother me about my colleagues was it was all about success. Who had the most success? Who could dress up the most? Who had the biggest congregation? Who was well talked of, well thought of? Who had the money? If you follow the trail, the Stephanie, it's all about the money. Everybody wants the money. Well, I was never really like that. I was interested in what a deep inner potential was like, a spiritual awakening. I had been to India. I knew. I kept it a secret because there were so many things that I got hammered for by not only my colleagues, but by headquarters. And it's a long story, and I'm not going to get into it. But it all came down to, do we mature spiritually or do we grow intellectually? And do we grow in our possessions? Well, there are some people, you know, who would like to tell you, you can have both. Not really, but yeah, I understand. Yes, it is possible. There's no doubt about it, but it isn't necessary. If something is going to flower, it's going to flower. I can't make it flower. Your life is a flowering. My life is a flowering. How far will we go with that flowering? How far will we allow that flowering to offer its scent to the world? Some people will get it. Some people won't. Motivation is a big key in spiritual work. Why do we desire things and stuff that will only be discarded after our deaths? Because it's a proof that we were here. It is a part of the importance factor, self-esteem. We want to be remembered, and the only way we can do that is by the stuff, as you put it. And we didn't do anything with our life but gather stuff. We didn't achieve love. Stuff, and as you put it here, and things are what happens to people who don't achieve love. And all that stuff and those things create a karma in our life. So it is all about love. And no one sees this profound love that lives deep inside. If you achieve this great love, you're not going to find people running to you. They're not going to want to hang on your every word or your every breath. They will find you strange, sometimes annoying, and obnoxious at times. But that is just the way it is. Love is not popular in this world. Only human love is. And so when people say, you know, what the world needs now is love, sweet love, that would be true, but not the sweet love that the human heart wants. It is the love that truly is unconditional. it has no conditions to it at all in the earthly realm, and yet is very conditional when it comes to achieving it. You have to be disciplined. You have to want love more than wanting what you love. It is a discipline. So in a certain kind of way, there are conditions to the unconditional. There you are, Steph. You ask great questions, and I want to thank you for your questions. I always love hearing from you. And please don't hesitate to send more. Please forgive me. Namaste. The next question comes from Angela. She does not tell me where she lives. How many times must I be told I am wrong? How many times do I have to hear you on the radio and TV talk about things that I don't want to do and don't do? Is there ever a right with you, Angela? Angela, you sound like you're a disgruntled person, huh? Are you disgruntled? It is a good question, though. How many times do you have to be told, no, that's not it. No, you're not getting it. No, you're going the wrong way. Before you choose to go the more intelligent way. And I don't mean psychologically intelligent. I'm talking about heartfelt intelligence, which does not have anything to do with the human heart. It is a very difficult road to haul, isn't it? And most people just can't do it. Most people won't do it. They won't see the bigger picture. They don't want to see the bigger picture, nor do they care to understand the depth of the way. So how many times? It depends on you. When you and I stop resisting the way, then we won't be told anymore, Angela, that is not the way of whatever it is we're doing. Maybe you need to look at what you're really looking for. What are you really looking for? And are you looking for a method, some kind of modality, some kind of philosophy that you think you can adopt that will help you understand what it is you're supposed to be doing and how you're supposed to be doing it? Is that what you're looking for? I don't know what you're looking for. It sounds to me like you want what a lot of people want, fast, quick, and easy, and no-brainer kind of thing. And if that's the case, then you're missing, because this work, this practice, everything we do is very, very much dedicated to discipline, and the discipline of no longer talking to our mind, getting involved in our emotionality, starting to drop words and not listening to thoughts that take us astray. And that's just the way it is. I don't make up the rules here. It just is the way it is. So you've got to decide, Angela, how far you want to go. I had a Zen master in Lawrence, Kansas, when I was in seminary and I was starting my interest in meditation. And as we all left in this summer when I was being ordained and moving on, he looked at me and he said, "Well, Greg, it's going to be one damn thing after another, and people are just no goddamn good, are they?" He was reflecting me and my attitude. It was terrible attitude. I didn't understand. Everybody else got these wonderful send-offs. But yeah, he was right. And as the years went on and I went on into my practice and my formal teaching, yes, it was one damn thing after another. And yes, people were unkind. And yes, he was right about. And I started to look at it. It's all in me. I am the projection of all of that. So I had to do some changing. You're going to have to obviously do some changing. And if you do, if you start to take the more poor in spirit attitude, you'll find that a lot of things change very rapidly. And life will look different. Honestly, it will, through different eyes. I'm out of here. Have a beautiful day. Thank you, Angela, for your question, and please forgive me. Namaste. Well, there you are. I got more questions tomorrow. If you ever want to ask a question, you know you can write me at greg@aspire.org. That's greg@aspire, aspire.org. See you tomorrow. Thank you for listening, and please forgive me, eh? Namaste.